Girl-like muscles did not attract girls, and Warren had still not gone out on any dates since he arrived at Penn. Saturdays were big fraternity party days, with pre-football luncheons and post-game cocktail parties, dinners, and evening dances. Warren wrote a letter to Bobby Worley asking her to come up for a weekend and saying, in effect, that he had fallen in love. Bobby liked him and was touched by his letter, but did not return his feelings. She would have enjoyed the weekend, but said no because she felt it was wrong to lead him on. Warren had one date with Anne Beck, a Bryn Mawr girl. He had worked at her father's bakery shortly after moving to Washington when he was in eighth grade and she was just a little girl with long blonde hair. Anne had been voted the most bashful girl at her high school, and the day she and Warren spent together was like a shyness contest. They walked around Philadelphia in awkward silence. We were probably the two shyest people in the whole United States. Warren had no idea how to make small talk. When stressed, he emitted small grunts instead. Sometimes Warren and Clyde took the borrowed Ford coupe and drove off to the suburbs in search of movies about mummies, Frankenstein, vampires, or anything macabre. Since hardly anybody had a car at that time, his fraternity brothers were impressed. That was the irony. Warren was the only one with a car to make out in, but nobody to make out with. He passed on the Ivy Ball and the Interfraternity Ball. He always skipped the Alpha Sig Sunday tea dances and never had a date at the fraternity house. His face would flush and he would stare at his shoes if anyone talked about sex. He was out of his element at such a hard partying school, where the college fight song was, "Drink a highball." I tried drinking because I was in a fraternity where about half my dues were going to buy alcohol for these parties. I felt I was getting screwed, but I just didn't like the taste. I don't like beer, and I can behave silly enough without it. I mean, I was right there with the rest. The drinkers didn't have anything on me when it came to being silly. But even without a date on his arm or a glass in his hand, Warren sometimes showed up at his fraternity's Saturday night parties. He was able to draw a little crowd by sitting in a corner and lecturing on the stock market. He had a wit and an arresting way of talking. His Alpha Sig brothers deferred to his opinion when it came to money and business. They respected his deep, if one-sided, knowledge of politics. They decided he had some politician in him and gave him a paddle with his nickname, the Senator. Warren had joined the Young Republicans as a freshman because he was attracted to a girl who was a member. But instead of becoming her boyfriend, he became the group's president when he was a sophomore. Warren took over at an exciting time, the fall of a presidential election year. In 1948, the Republicans were supporting Thomas F. Dewey against the weak incumbent, Harry Truman, who had become president on FDR's death. The Buffetts had grown to hate Truman. Though he had created what was known as the Truman Doctrine of Containment, which was meant to prevent the spread of communism, Howard, like many conservatives, felt that Truman and General George C. Marshall, his Secretary of State, were playing palsy-walsy with Soviet Premier Stalin. Moreover, Truman had implemented the Marshall Plan, which sent 18 million tons of food to Europe after World War II, and Howard was one of 74 congressmen who had voted against it. Convinced that the Marshall Plan was another version of Operation Rat Hole and that the Democrats were wrecking the economy, Howard started buying gold chain bracelets for his daughters so they could feed themselves when the day came that the dollar was worthless. Howard was running for re-election to his fourth term that year. Even though Warren had been present when Howard was hissed and booed after he'd voted for passage of the Taft-Hartley slave labor bill, he, like the rest of the family, considered Howard's congressional seat relatively safe. Nonetheless, Howard had placed his re-election in the hands of a campaign manager for the first time, family friend Dr. William Thompson. Well-known and admired in Omaha, Thompson knew the pulse of the town and was a psychologist to boot. Day after day, as the campaign progressed, people in Omaha would come up and say, "Congratulations, Howard, you're in again, and I worked for you," as if the election were over. Dewey, too, appeared to be a shoo-in. The polls showed that Truman was trailing him badly, in fact, so badly that the Roper Organization, a polling research firm, simply stopped taking polls. Truman ignored this, and for months had been traveling around the country speaking from the back of his train on a whistle-stop tour, advocating what he called his Fair Deal policy: universal health insurance, broad-based civil rights legislation, and the repeal of Taft-Hartley. He had whistle-stopped in Omaha, marched in a parade, and dedicated a park, looking as cheerful as if he hadn't read the newspapers predicting his defeat. As Election Day approached, in happy anticipation of his father's re-election and of Dewey's victory, Warren made arrangements with the Philadelphia Zoo to ride an elephant down Woodland Avenue on November 3rd. He envisioned it as a sort of triumphal march, like Hannibal entering Sardinia. But on the morning after Election Day, Warren had to cancel his stunt. Not only had Truman won the 1948 election, but his father had lost. The voters had thrown Howard Buffett out of Congress. "I'd never ridden an elephant before. When Truman beat Dewey, the elephant went down the tube. And my dad lost an election for the first time in four campaigns. That was a really lousy day." 2 months later, just a few days before the Buffetts left Washington at the end of Howard's term, Warren's great-uncle Frank died. Frank had boomed, "It's going to zero," about every stock down at Harris Upham when Warren was a boy, and when his will was read, the family discovered that he owned government bonds and nothing else. He had outlived the gold digger, and the terms of his will placed the bonds in a restricted trust that required that, upon maturing, they could only be reinvested in more U.S. government bonds. As if to convince his nephew and trustee, Howard, Frank had also apparently left various family members subscriptions to Baxter's Letter, a doomsday sheet that preached that government bonds were the only safe investment. Frank meant to be at peace in the afterlife, the only Buffett, so far, to arrange that his opinions would resound from the grave. But Howard, of course, dreaded inflation and believed that government bonds could turn into worthless paper. Overcoming his scruples, he went to work to break the terms of Frank's will and got a judge to approve some technical changes so the money could eventually be invested in stocks. These events took place during what Lila called the worst winter in years. Blizzards buried the Midwest, and hay had to be airlifted to Nebraska from surrounding states for weeks during the freeze to keep the snowbound livestock from dying on their feet. The winter of the haylift became emblematic of the Truman victory. Howard, who had never gotten rich, now had two kids in college and another about to start. He went back to work at his old firm, now known as Buffett Falk, but his partner, Carl Falk, who had been handling his clients during his absence in Washington, was not interested in sharing them now. Striding around downtown Omaha with the bitter snow pelting his face, Howard tried to drum up new clients. But his long absence meant that his writings were the way most people knew him now, and articles like "Human Freedom Rests on Gold Redeemable Money" had given him the reputation of an extremist. In the spring of 1949, he went out into the countryside and knocked on farmhouse doors in search of a new clientele. As for Warren, his father's defeat left him heartsick, but also offered him an excuse for leaving the East Coast. He was bored at school and hated Philadelphia so much that he had nicknamed it Filthy-delphia. At the end of the spring semester, he headed back home for good, so relieved that he signed his letters X. Wharton Buffett. He rationalized this by saying that enrolling at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, where he would spend the last years of his college career, would be cheaper than Penn. He gave the little Ford coupe back to David Brown, its tires threadbare. It was Brown's problem to figure out how to replace them, since tires were still rationed. Warren wanted only one memento of Penn. On the way out the door, he and Clyde flipped a coin to see who got to keep their treasured copy of S.J. Simon's Why You Lose at Bridge. Warren won. Chapter 15. The Interview. Lincoln and Chicago, 1949 to the summer of 1950. The first thing Warren did on returning to Nebraska in that summer of 1949 was get a job in newspapers, managing country circulation for the Lincoln Journal. He and his friend Truman Wood, who was Doris's boyfriend, went halves on a car. Warren felt comfortable in Lincoln, going to university classes in the morning, then driving around managing his route in the afternoon. In his spare moments, he called on the local newspaper editors and talked business, politics, and journalism. Supervising rural paperboys was a serious job, for he was now the boss. 50 young boys in 6 rural counties reported to Mr. Buffett. The challenges of management suddenly became clear when he hired a minister's daughter in the town of Beatrice, thinking she would be a responsible paper carrier. The 3 paper boys in Beatrice promptly quit. He'd turned it into a sissy job. Warren spent part of his time that summer in Omaha, selling men's furnishings at JCPenney's. His spirits had begun to revive. He bought a ukulele to compete with the uke-playing boyfriend of a girl he was pursuing, but wound up holding only the ukulele instead of the girl. Penny's, however, was a good place to work. The employees put on an unofficial pep rally in the basement every morning where Warren, clad in a cheap suit, played his new ukulele, off the clock, while everyone sang, before heading off to his 75-cents-an-hour job in men's furnishings. Penny's called him back over the Christmas holidays, improbably putting him to work selling menswear and town craft shirts. Looking at racks filled with products about as comprehensible to him as a French restaurant menu, he asked his manager what to tell the customers about the clothes. "Just tell them it's a sort of worsted," Mr. Lanford said. "Nobody knows what a worsted is." Warren never did learn what a worsted was, but at JCPenney's he sold nothing but. Worsted, commonly used in men's suiting, is a high-quality, tightly woven wool fabric made of long staple fibers. In the fall, he had moved into a furnished house on Pepper Avenue in Lincoln, which he shared with Truman Wood, and started full-time at the University of Nebraska. He liked the teachers better than at Penn, and he enrolled with a heavy course load, studying accounting with Ray Dine, the best professor he had had thus far. That year, Warren revived his golf ball business, this time with a college friend from Penn, Jerry Orens, as a partner. He would drive down to the Omaha train station and pick up the golf balls from his old supplier, Half Wittick. Orens acted as his East Coast distributor, but in fact, Warren had always wanted partners for the sake of partnership alone. In every business venture, he looked to friends to partner with him. Needless to say, in Warren's partnerships, he was always the senior partner. He was also investing and got the idea of shorting stock in the automaker Kaiser Frazier. This company produced its first cars in 1947, but saw its share of the auto market fall from nearly 1 out of every 20 cars to fewer than 1 out of every 100 in less than a year. "Dear Pop," he wrote his father on Nebraska Cornhusker stationery, "if there isn't a trend line apparent in those percentages, I'm no statistician." Kaiser Frazier had lost $8 million during the first 6 months, so even with phony bookkeeping, the loss will probably run more. He and Howard shorted the stock together. Back at school, he went down to the broker Cruttenden Podesta's office and asked a stockbroker, Bob Soner, where the stock was trading. Soner looked at the chalkboard and said, $5. Warren explained that he had shorted the stock, borrowing shares to sell. If the price dropped, as he expected, he could buy the stock back, return the shares, and keep the difference. Since Warren thought Kaiser Frazier was going bust, if he had sold the shares at $5, he could buy them back for pennies and make nearly $5 on each share. "I'll show this young whippersnapper," thought Soner. "You're not old enough to short a stock legally," he said. "Oh, yes," Warren said. "I did it in my older sister Doris's name." He explained why the stock was going to zero and laid out the evidence. "And he cut my feet right out from under me," says Soner. "I had no retort whatsoever." Warren waited for the Kaiser Frazier idea to work. And waited. He started hanging around Cruttenden Podesta while he waited. He was convinced the idea would work. It was so obvious that Kaiser Frazier would eventually go broke. Meanwhile, he and Soner became friends. In the spring of 1950, Warren was close to finishing college. After 3 years of study, he only needed to take a few classes at summer school to graduate. And then he made a decision that completely reversed his path to date. After high school, he had felt fully qualified to achieve his goal of becoming a millionaire by age 35 with no further education. But now that he was close to graduating, at the point when most people are done studying and ready to go to work, Warren prepared to put work aside. He had fixed his ambitions on attending the Harvard Business School. Throughout his entire educational history, he had shown little interest in formal schooling, as opposed to learning, and considered himself largely self-taught. Harvard, however, offered him two important things: prestige and a network of future connections. He had just seen his father thrown out of Congress and his career as a stockbroker crushed, in part because he had tended to isolate himself by sacrificing relationships for the sake of rigid ideals. So perhaps it was not surprising that Warren chose Harvard. He was so certain that Harvard would choose him that he was already urging his friend Big Jerry Orens to join me at Harvard. Furthermore, he wasn't even going to have to pay for all of his tuition. One day I read in the Daily Nebraskan a little item that said, "The John E. Miller Scholarship will be awarded today. Applicants should go to room 300 at the Business Administration Building." And it provided $500 to go to the accredited school of your choice. $500 was not chicken feed. It would have been equivalent to about $4,300 in 2007. I went to room 300, and I was the only guy who showed up. The three professors there kept wanting to wait. I said, "No, no, it was 3 o'clock." So I won the scholarship without doing anything. Enriched with this nugget mined from the college newspaper, Warren rose in the middle of the night to catch the train to Chicago, where his Harvard interview would take place. He was 19, 2 years younger than the average college graduate, and younger still than the average business school student. His grades were good, but not stellar. Despite being the son of a U.S. congressman, he was using no connections to try to get into Harvard. Since Howard Buffett scratched no backs, his own back went unscratched, and his son's as well. Warren was relying on his knowledge of stocks to make a good impression in the interview. So far, his experience had been that whenever he started talking about stocks, people could not help but listen. His relatives, his teachers, his parents' friends, his fellow students, all wanted to hear him discourse on this subject. But he had misunderstood Harvard's mission, which was to turn out leaders. When he arrived in Chicago and introduced himself to the interviewer, the man saw past his confidence as a prodigy in a single subject straight through to his self-consciousness, his shaky inner core. I looked about 16, and emotionally was about 9. I spent 10 minutes with the Harvard alumnus who was doing the interview, and he assessed my capabilities and turned me down. Warren never got the chance to show off his knowledge of stocks. The man from Harvard told him gently that he would have a better chance in a few years. Warren was naive. It did not quite sink in what this meant. When the letter arrived from Harvard refusing him admission, he was shocked. His first thought, he says, was, "What am I going to tell my dad?" Awkward and stiff-necked he might be, but Howard was undemanding of his children. The Harvard dream was Warren's, not his father's. Howard was accustomed to failure and resolute in defeat. The real question must have been, "What am I going to tell my mom?" These conversations took place, but their memory has drained away. And yet, Warren would later come to consider his rejection by Harvard the pivotal episode of his life. Almost immediately, he started investigating other graduate schools. While leafing through the Columbia catalog one day, he came across two names that were familiar to him: Benjamin Graham and David Dodd. "These were big names to me. I just read Graham's book, but I had no idea he was teaching at Columbia." Graham's book was The Intelligent Investor, published in 1949. This book of practical counsel for all types of investors, the cautious or defensive, and speculative or enterprising, blew apart the conventions of Wall Street, overturning what had heretofore been largely uninformed speculation in stocks. It explained for the first time in a way that ordinary people could understand that the stock market does not operate through black magic. Through examples of real stocks, such as the Northern Pacific Railway and the American Hawaiian Steamship Company, Graham illustrated a rational, mathematical approach to valuing stocks. Investing, he said, should be systematic. The book had mesmerized Warren. For years, he had been going downtown to the library and checking out every book available on stocks and investing. Many of the books dealt with stock-picking systems based on models and patterns. Warren wanted a system, something that would work reliably. He had been fascinated by numerical patterns, technical analysis. I read all of them over and over. The book that probably had the most influence on me was Garfield Drew, who wrote an important book about odd-lot stock trading. I read that about 3 times. I read Edwards and McGee, which is the Bible of technical analysis. I would go down to the library and just clean them out. But when he found The Intelligent Investor, he read it and reread it. It was almost like he found a god, said Truman Wood, his housemate. After careful study and thought, he had gone ahead and made a value investment on his own. Through a connection of his father's, he had heard of a company called Parkersburg Rig and Reel, which he researched according to Graham's rules. He bought 200 shares. According to the catalog Warren had now picked up, the man who had become his favorite author, Ben Graham, was lecturing in finance at Columbia University, and David Dodd was there too. Dodd was associate dean of the Graduate School of Business and head of the Department of Finance. In 1934, Graham and Dodd had co-authored the seminal text on investing, Security Analysis. The Intelligent Investor was the layman's version of security analysis. Enrolling at Columbia would mean he could study with Graham and Dodd. And as Columbia's catalog pointed out, no other city in the world offers as many opportunities to become acquainted at first hand with the actual conduct of business. Here, a student may come into personal contact with the outstanding leaders of American business, many of whom give generously of their time to take part in seminars, institutes, and conferences. Business establishments of the city cheerfully welcome groups of students as visitors. Even Harvard could not offer this. Warren now determined that he would go to Columbia, but it was almost too late. I wrote in August, about a month before school started, way past when you were supposed to do it. Who knows what I wrote? I probably wrote that I just found this catalog at the University of Omaha, and it said that you and Ben Graham taught, whereas I thought you guys were on Mount Olympus someplace just smiling down on the rest of us. And if I can get in, I'd love to come. I'm sure it was not a very conventional application. It was probably fairly personal. But in a written application, however unconventional, Warren could shape the impression he made more successfully than in a personal interview. The application wound up on the desk of David Dodd, who, as associate dean, was in charge of admissions. By 1950, after teaching at Columbia for 27 years, Dodd had effectively become the junior partner of the famous Benjamin Graham. A thin, frail, balding man who cared for a disabled wife at home, Dodd was the son of a Presbyterian minister and 8 years older than Warren's father. While Dodd may have been touched in some way by the personal nature of the application, it was also true that at Columbia, he and Graham were more interested in their students' aptitude for business and investing than their emotional maturity. Graham and Dodd were not trying to create leaders. They taught a specialized craft. Whatever the reason, after the deadline and without an interview, Warren was accepted by Columbia. Chapter 16. Strike 1. New York City, Fall 1950. Warren arrived in New York City alone. The only person he knew there was his aunt Dorothy Stahl, widow of the revered Marion Stahl. Otherwise, the motherly women to whom he usually attached himself were unavailable. His teachers and classmates at the business school would consist almost entirely of men. Unlike Penn, where his family had been only a couple of hours away, he was on his own, and his father was once again immersed in politics, running to regain his seat in Congress, this time managing the campaign himself. But even if he won, New York was a long way from Washington. Warren had applied to Columbia too late to get into a university dorm, so he found the cheapest lodgings available, joining the YMCA for a dime a day and paying a dollar a day for a room at the Y's Sloan House on West 34th Street, down near Penn Station. He was far from broke, enriched by $500 from the Miller Scholarship and $2,000 from Howard, a graduation gift and part of a deal not to start smoking. He also had $9,803.70 saved, some of it placed in stocks. His net worth included $44 in cash, his half interest in the car, and $334 invested in his half-Wittick golf ball business. But since Warren looked at every dollar as $10 someday, he wasn't going to hand over a dollar more than he needed to spend. Every penny was another snowflake for his snowball. On his first day in David Dodd's class, Finance 111 to 112, Investment Management and Security Analysis, he recalls that Dodd broke his customary reserve and greeted him personally and warmly. Warren had already more or less memorized the course textbook, Security Analysis, Graham and Dodd's seminal book on investing. As the principal drafter and organizer of Security Analysis, Dodd was, of course, intimately familiar with its contents. Yet when it came to the text itself, Buffett says, "The truth was that I knew the book even better than Dodd. I could quote from any part of it. At that time, literally, almost in those whole 700 or 800 pages, I knew every example. I had just sopped it up." And you can imagine the effect that would have on the guy, that somebody was that keen on his book. Published in 1934, Security Analysis was a mammoth textbook for serious students of the market, laying out in much more detail the innovative concepts that were later summarized for a popular audience in The Intelligent Investor. Dodd had taken meticulous notes at Ben Graham's lectures and seminars for 4 years, organizing them and enriching the examples with his own knowledge of corporate finance and accounting. He structured the book and proofread the galleys from his summer home on the rustic Chabig Island in Maine's Casco Bay, in between golf games and mackerel fishing tournaments. He described his role modestly. The genius was Graham's, supplemented by long experience of a distinguished character and exceptional literary talent. My most important role was to be a devil's advocate on a variety of issues where I thought he had got himself out on a limb. Dodd's class focused on valuing defaulted railroad bonds. Since childhood, Warren had been slightly obsessed with trains, and, of course, thanks to the long, checkered, and colorful history of the Union Pacific, Omaha was practically the center of the universe when it came to bankrupt railroads. Warren had read his favorite book on bonds, Townsend's Bond Salesmanship, for the first time at the age of 7, after making a special plea to Santa Claus for this tome. Now he took to the subject of bankrupt railroad bonds like a duck to the warm spring rain. Unsurprisingly, Dodd showed an unusual interest in him, introducing him to his family and taking him to dinner. Warren soaked up the fatherly attention and also felt sympathy for Dodd, who cared for his mentally ill wife. In class, Dodd would ask a question, and Warren's arm would shoot into the air before anyone else's, waving for attention. He knew the answer every time, wanted to give it, was not afraid of attention, and did not mind looking silly. Nor did he seem to be showing off, as a classmate recalled. He was simply young, eager, and immature. Unlike Warren, most of his Columbia classmates had little interest in stocks and bonds, and were probably bored by this mandatory class. They were a remarkably homogeneous group of men, mostly headed to General Motors, IBM, or U.S. Steel after they got their degrees. One of them, Bob Dunn, was on his way to becoming the academic star of the class of 1951. Warren admired his presence and intelligence, and often went over to the dorm to visit him. One afternoon, in the other room of Dunn's two-room suite, Fred Stanback found himself wakened from a nap by a loud voice. Half asleep, he began to realize that the voice was saying such interesting things that he didn't want to doze off again. Rising from his bunk, he wandered into the next room. There, he found a crew-cut, badly dressed kid, rattling a mile a minute, who leaned forward in his seat as if a starting gun were poised behind his head. Stanbeck plopped down in a chair and began to listen to Warren, who was declaiming with great authority about some undervalued stocks he'd found. It was clear Warren had already immersed himself in the stock market. He talked about a clutch of tiny companies, including Tire Rubber Company and Sargent & Co., which made locks, and a somewhat larger business, hardware wholesaler Marshall Wells. Listening, Stanback became an instant disciple. He went out straight away and bought stocks for the first time in his life. Stanback was the son of a live wire salesman who had gotten rich peddling envelopes of headache powder and snap-back stimulant powders, full of caffeine, from the back seat of a Model T Ford. Fred Jr. grew up, analytical and reserved, on Confederate Avenue in the tiny hamlet of Salisbury, North Carolina. He was a born audience for Warren. The two started spending time together, a fast-talking, scrawny-looking kid and a sandy blonde, handsome young man with a molasses voice. One day, Warren had an idea. He asked Professor Dodd's permission to cut class to attend the annual meeting of Marshall Wells. A few months before starting at Columbia, he and Howard had jointly bought 25 shares of the stock. Marshall Wells was this wholesale hardware company up in Duluth, Minnesota. That was the first annual meeting I ever attended. They held their meeting in Jersey City, New Jersey, probably so fewer shareholders would attend. Warren's vision of shareholder meetings rose from his conception of the nature of a business. He had recently sold his tenant farm, doubling his money over 5 years. During the time he had owned it, he and his tenant farmer had shared the profits on the crop, but his tenant didn't share the profits from selling the land. As the capitalist, Warren put up the money and took the risk, and then he got the gain, if there was any. Warren thought of all businesses this way. The employees who managed the business shared in the earnings that their labors produced, but they were accountable to their owners, and it was the owners who got the gains as the value of the business increased. Of course, if the employees bought stock themselves, they became owners too, and partners with the other capitalists. But no matter how much stock they owned, as employees, their job required them to report to the owners on how well they had done. Thus, Warren saw a shareholder meeting as a time of accounting for the stewardship of the managers. This vision was rarely shared by company managements, however. Warren and his new friend Stanback took the train to Jersey City. Arriving in a drab meeting room on an upper floor of the Corporation Trust Company, they found half a dozen people awaiting a session in which the company planned to shuffle through an agenda of legal obligations in a perfunctory fashion. Paradoxically, management's indifference and shareholder negligence both worked on Warren's behalf, for the fewer folks came to the show, the more valuable would be whatever knowledge he could wrest from the company. One of those few was Walter Schloss, a 34-year-old man who was working for the pittance of $50 a week as one of four employees of Ben Graham's company, the Graham Newman Corporation. As the meeting began, Schloss started asking pointed questions of management. He was a bantamweight, mild-mannered, dark-haired man from a family of New York Jewish immigrants, but he probably struck the Marshall Wells crowd as abrupt by the standards of Duluth. "They were a little upset," says Stanback, "that these outsiders were barging in on their meeting. They'd never had anybody come to their meeting before, and they didn't like that." Warren was immediately taken with Schloss's approach, and when Schloss identified himself as working for Graham Newman, he reacted as though at a family reunion. As soon as the meeting ended, Warren approached Schloss, and they began to talk. He found him a man after his own heart, a believer that wealth is hard to accumulate and easy to lose. Schloss's grandfather had dallied away his hours in New York City at the Harmony Club, leaving his apparel company in the charge of a bookkeeper who, as custodian of the money and the records, applied himself to using the latter to embezzle the former. Next, his father had set up a radio factory with a partner. The warehouse burned down under suspicious circumstances before a single radio was sold. Then, when Walter was 13, his mother lost her inheritance in the crash of 1929. The Schloss family got by through perspiration and determination. Walter's father got a job as a factory manager, then sold stamps. Fresh out of high school in 1934, Walter worked as a Wall Street runner, a member of the Pony Express of the brokerage firms, carrying messages up and down the street. Next, working in the company's cage, handling securities, he had asked his boss if he could analyze stocks. The answer was no, but he was told, "There's a fellow named Ben Graham who's just written a book called Security Analysis. Read that book and you won't need anything else." Schloss read Graham's book cover to cover and wanted more. Two nights a week, from 5 to 7, he started going to the New York Institute of Finance, where Graham taught investing. Graham had begun these seminars in 1927 as trial runs for a college course he was thinking of teaching at Columbia. At the time, the public couldn't get enough of stocks, and the class was packed. "Although I warned my students that any stocks mentioned were for illustration only and under no circumstances were to be taken as recommendations to buy, it did happen that some of the issues I discussed as undervalued subsequently enjoyed substantial advances," he said, in something of an understatement. When Graham mentioned names of stocks he was currently buying, people like Gustav Levy, the head trader at Goldman Sachs, scurried back to act on these ideas and made their firms and themselves rich. Schloss was so captivated that he wound up as one of a couple of employees working for his idol, Ben Graham, and his partner, Jerry Newman. Warren found himself instinctively drawn to Walter, not just for his enviable job, but also because of the story of his gritty, disadvantaged background. At the Marshall Wells meeting, Warren also recognized another shareholder by his barrel-shouldered, cigar-smoking profile. This was Lewis Green, a well-known investor who was a partner in a small but respected securities firm, Stryker & Brown, and an ally of Ben Graham's. Together, Green, Graham, and Jerry Newman hunted for companies whose stock was cheaper than a warehouse full of stale Barbecubes dog biscuits. They tried to buy enough stock to get elected to the board of directors and thus influence management. Warren was mightily impressed by Lou Green and wanted to make a good impression, so he struck up a conversation with him, and he and Stanbeck and Green rode back together on the train from New Jersey. Green offered to take the two young men to lunch. That was like hitting the jackpot. Warren discovered Green was tight-fisted, a man after his own heart. "This guy was enormously wealthy, and we went to some cafeteria or something like that." At lunch, Green began explaining what it was like to be pursued by women who were after his money. As he was somewhat past middle age, his technique for dealing with this was to confront the woman's motives directly. "You like these false teeth? How about my bald head? Or the pot belly?" Warren was enjoying the conversation until Green suddenly changed the subject and put him on the spot. He said to me, "Why did you buy Marshall Wells?" And I said, "Because Ben Graham bought it." True, Graham was already his hero, even though the two had never met, and since the inspiration for buying Marshall Wells had indeed come from security analysis, Warren may have felt he had to be scrupulous about how he had learned of it. But in fact, he had good reason to own Marshall Wells beyond its mention in security analysis. Reputedly the largest hardware wholesaler in North America, Marshall Wells was earning so much money that if it had paid out those earnings to shareholders as a dividend, they would have gotten $62 a share. The stock traded at around $200 a share. Owning a Marshall Wells share was something like owning a bond, one that paid 31% interest, the $62 earnings on a $200 share. At that rate, in 3 years, Warren would have nearly $2 of value for every dollar he had invested in Marshall Wells. Even if the company didn't pay the money out, the stock would have to rise eventually. You would be crazy to pass up such a stock. But Warren did not explain any of this to Lou Green. Instead, he said, "Because Ben Graham bought it." Lou looked at me and said, "Strike one." I'll never forget the way he looked at me when he said it. It dawned on him. "Warren, think for yourself." He felt foolish. "We're sitting in this little cafeteria. I'm with this impressive character. And all of a sudden, I'm striking out." He did not want to make any more mistakes like this, and he did want to find more stocks like Marshall Wells. So, as Graham's seminar approached, Warren started memorizing everything he could find out about Ben Graham's method, his books, his specific investments, and Graham himself. He had learned that Graham was chairman of the board of a company called Government Employees Insurance Company, or GEICO. This stock was not mentioned in security analysis. When he looked in the Moody's manual, he found that the Graham Newman Corporation had owned 55% of it, but had recently given out the stock to its shareholders. What was this Geico? Warren was curious. So on a cold, wintry Saturday morning a few weeks later, he jumped on the earliest train to Washington, D.C., and showed up at Geico's door. No one was about, but a guard answered his knock. As he recalls, Warren asked in his humblest manner whether anyone was there who might explain Geico's business to him. He made sure to mention that he was a student of Ben Graham's. The guard trotted upstairs to the office where Geico's financial vice president, Lorimer Davidson, sat working. Faced with this request, Davidson thought to himself that, being a pupil of Ben's, I would give him 5 minutes and thank him, find a polite way of sending him on his way. He told the guard to show Warren in. Warren introduced himself to Davidson with precise but flattering sincerity. My name is Warren Buffett. I'm a student at Columbia. Ben Graham is going to be, probably, my professor. I read his book, and I think he's wonderful. And I noticed that he's the chairman of Government Employees Insurance. I don't know anything about it, but I wanted to come here and learn. Davidson started talking to Warren about the arcane business of auto insurance, thinking that out of kindness to a pupil of Graham's, he would waste a few minutes of his valuable time. But, he said, after about 10 to 12 minutes of his questions, I realized that I was talking to a highly unusual young man. The questions he was asking me were the questions that would have been asked by an experienced insurance stock analyst. His follow-up questions were professional. He was young, and he looked young. He described himself as a student, but he was talking like a man who had been around a long time, and he knew a great deal. When my opinion of Warren changed, I began asking him questions, and I found out that he had been a successful businessman at age 16, that he had filed his own income tax at age 14 and every year since then, that he had had a number of small businesses. Lorimer Davidson had accomplished so much himself that he was hard to impress. Davy, as he was universally known, had been a mediocre student, but, he says, almost from the time I was 10, 11 years old, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be just what my father was. I never thought of any other business than being a bond salesman. He saw Wall Street as Mecca, the ultimate place. In 1924, Davidson had made $1,800 in commissions in his first week selling bonds. Over time, he began to play the stock market using borrowed money, trading radio, the Radio Corporation of America, or RCA. In July 1929, he shorted radio, which was trading at an absurd price, betting that it would go down. But absurd prices can become even more absurd, and when the stock went up another 150 points, Davidson lost everything. Then, when the market crashed on October 29th, he had to forget his pregnant wife and the loss of every cent he'd ever made in order to navigate the horror his clients now faced. He and his colleagues stayed up until 5 a.m. calling their accounts. Almost without exception, they, too, had traded on borrowed money. At first, the clients came up with the cash to repay their loans. Market seers and government officials kept saying stocks would quickly rebound. They got the velocity right, but the direction all wrong. With each succeeding wave of margin calls, half of Davidson's remaining clients were wiped out, unable to pay their debts, forfeiting their accounts. Davidson, who had been pocketing an incredible $100,000 a year in commissions before the crash, was soon making about $100 a week selling bonds and considering himself well off. It was a pretty sorry sight, he recalled of those depression years, to see an old friend, married with children, very successful, and now he has to work to get a nickel for an apple, selling fruit at the corner of Wall and Broad. It was through his job selling bonds that Davy happened to call on the Government Employees Insurance Company. When he found out how Geico worked, he was instantly captivated. Geico sought to make auto insurance cheaper by marketing through the mail without an agent. That was a revolutionary concept at the time. To make it work, Geico needed a rule that would allow it to avoid the folks who drive 30 miles over the speed limit after downing half a bottle of tequila at 3 a.m., borrowing an idea from a company called USAA that sold only to military officers, Geico's founders, Leo Goodwin and Cleves Rhea, had decided to sell its insurance only to government employees because, like military officers, they were responsible individuals who were accustomed to following the law. Better still, there were a lot of them. Thus, the Government Employees Insurance Company was born. Later, the Rhea family had hired Davidson to sell their stock, since they were based in Texas and no longer wanted to commute. While putting together a syndicate of buyers, he approached Graham Newman Corporation in New York. Ben Graham was interested, but deferred to his gruff partner, Jerry Newman. Jerry thought that to buy something at the offering price was illegal. He said, "I never bought anything at the offering price before. I'm not going to start now," Davidson said. They dickered. Davidson brought Jerry Newman around to investing $1 million for 55% of the company, with some modest concessions. Ben Graham became chairman of GEICO, and Newman joined its board. 6 or 7 months later, Lorimer Davidson told GEICO's CEO Leo Goodwin that he would take a pay cut to work for GEICO, managing its investments. Goodwin consulted with Ben Graham, who agreed. Hearing this story from Davidson, Warren was fascinated. "I just kept asking questions about insurance and GEICO. He didn't go to lunch that day. He just sat there and talked to me for 4 hours like I was the most important person in the world. When he opened that door to me, he opened the door to the insurance world." Now, the door to the insurance world is one most people would rather stayed firmly nailed shut. But insurance was taught in business schools. Warren had studied it at Penn, and there was an aspect of it a little like gambling that intrigued the odds maker in him. He had become interested in an insurance scheme called a tontine, in which people pool their money and the last survivor gets the whole pot. But tontines were now illegal. Warren had even considered actuarial science, the mathematics of insurance, as a career. He could have spent decades toiling over tables of mortality statistics, handicapping people's life expectancies. Besides the obvious ways this suited his personality, which tended toward specialization, relished memorizing, collecting, and manipulating numbers, and preferred solitude, working as a life actuary would have let him spend his time pondering one of his two favorite preoccupations, life expectancy. However, his other favorite, collecting money, had won out. Warren was starting to grapple with the fundamental concept of business. How do companies make money? A company was much like a person. It had to go out and find a way to keep a roof over its employees' and shareholders' heads. He grasped that because GEICO sold insurance at the cheapest price, the only way it could make money would be to have the lowest possible costs. He also learned that insurance companies take their customers' premiums and invest them long before the claims are paid. That sounded to him like getting to use somebody else's money for free, just the kind of idea that appealed to him. GEICO seemed to Warren a no-lose proposition. That Monday, less than 48 hours after he arrived back in New York, Warren dumped stocks worth 3/4 of his growing portfolio and used the cash to buy 350 shares of GEICO. It was an extraordinary move for the normally cautious young man. That was especially true because, at its current price, GEICO was an investment that Ben Graham would not have approved of, even though Graham Newman had only recently become its largest shareholder. Graham's idea was to buy stocks trading for less than the value of their assets, and he did not believe in concentrating in just a few stocks. But Warren was amazed by what he had learned from Lorimer Davidson. GEICO was growing so fast that he felt confident of being able to predict what it would be worth in a few years. On that basis, it was cheap. He wrote a report about it for his father's stock brokerage firm, saying that GEICO was trading at $42 per share, a multiple of about 8 times its recent earnings per share. Other insurance companies, he noted, were selling at much higher multiples of their earnings. Yet GEICO was a small company in a large field, whereas its competitors were companies whose growth possibilities have largely been exhausted. Warren then made a conservative projection of the company's value in 5 years. He thought the stock would be worth between $80 and $90 per share. A less Graham-like analysis could hardly be imagined. Graham's 1920s bubble and depression experiences had made him suspicious of earnings projections, so suspicious that while he paid lip service to this method of valuation in his teaching, He never used it himself in valuing stocks to buy for his firm. But Warren was betting three-quarters of his patiently accumulated money on the numbers he had calculated. In April, he wrote to Geyer & Co. and Blythe & Company, the most prominent brokerage firm specializing in insurance stocks, asking for their research. Next, he visited these experts to talk to them about GEICO. After he heard their views, he explained his own theory. They told Warren he was nuts. GEICO, they said, could not succeed over the larger, more established companies that used agents. It was a tiny company, with a market share of less than 1%. Huge insurance companies with thousands of agents dominated the industry, and so it would ever be. Yet here was GEICO, growing like a dandelion in June and printing money like the U.S. Mint. Warren didn't understand why they couldn't see what was right before their eyes. Chapter 17. Mount Everest. New York City, Spring, 1951. As his second semester began at Columbia, Warren hummed with excitement. His father had just been re-elected to Congress for a fourth time, by the largest majority yet, and he was finally going to meet his hero. In his memoir, Ben Graham describes himself as a loner who never had an intimate friend after high school. "I was cut out to be everybody's friend, but no one's bosom pal or crony. Nobody cracked his shell. Men all admired him. They all liked him, and they all wanted to be his friend more than he wanted them to be. You came away feeling terrific about him, but you never got to be his pal." Buffett would later call this Graham's protective coating. Even his partner, David Dodd, never became an intimate. Graham had great difficulty in understanding and empathizing with others. People found him almost painful to talk to, so cerebral, so erudite, so clever. He was not relaxing to be around. People had to keep their wits about them all the time in his company. While he was always kind, he quickly tired of conversing with his fellow human beings. The real friends and intimates of his life were his favorite authors, Gibbon, Virgil, Milton, Lessing, and their subjects, which, he said, had far more significance for me and left a greater impression on my memory than the living people around me. Born Benjamin Grossbaum, Graham passed his first 25 years in a period when the country experienced 4 financial panics and 3 depressions. His family's fortune dwindled after his father's death when Ben was 9. His worldly, ambitious mother lost most of her own small stake in the stock market panic of 1907, and she wound up having to pawn her jewelry. One of Graham's earliest memories was standing in a bank teller window, trying to cash his mother's check as the teller audibly asked a colleague whether Mrs. Grossbaum was good for $5. During this time, Graham recalled, the family was saved, through the charity of relatives, from misery, though not from humiliation. Nonetheless, Ben excelled throughout his education in the New York City public schools, where he read Victor Hugo in French, Goethe in German, Homer in Greek, and Virgil in Latin. Upon graduation, he wanted to attend Columbia University, but needed financial aid. When the scholarship examiner visited the Grossbaums, he turned Ben down. Ben's mother was convinced that he did so because the family still clung to a few Louis XVI chairs and some other fine pieces of furniture, despite its reduced circumstances. Ben, however, was sure the examiner had detected a secret deformity in his soul. "For years I had been struggling against something the French call mauvaise habitude, bad habits, a euphemism for masturbation, and which a combination of innate puritanism on my part and the hair-raising health tracks prevalent in those days had raised to a moral and physical issue of enormous proportions." Graham and his bad habits wound up at tuition-free City College, bereft and broke, convinced that a degree from this school would not advance him in the snobbish, cultivated world to which he aspired. The last straw came when 2 borrowed books were stolen from his locker and he had to pay to replace them. He had no pocket money at all. He dropped out, got a job assembling doorbells, and recited the Aeneid and the Rubaiyat to himself as he worked. Eventually, he reapplied to Columbia and this time was given the scholarship that had earlier been denied him, through a clerical error, it turned out. At Columbia, he became an academic star, even while working at a variety of menial jobs to help pay his expenses. Checking way bills, he would mentally compose sonnets for distraction. On graduation, he turned down a scholarship to law school, as well as offers from three different departments to teach philosophy, mathematics, and English, in order to follow his dean's advice and go into the advertising business. Graham's sense of humor always tended toward irony. His first effort at writing a jingle for the non-flammable cleaning fluid Carbona was rejected as too frightening to customers when he produced this limerick. There was a young girl from Winona who never had heard of Carbona. She started to clean with a can of benzene, and now her poor parents bemoan her. After this episode, Columbia's Dean Keppel recommended Graham for a job at the brokerage house Neuberger, Henderson, and Loeb. Graham said of Wall Street, "I knew it only by hearsay and in novels as a place of drama and excitement. I felt the urge to participate in its mysterious rituals and momentous events." He started in 1914 on the bottom rung of the Wall Street ladder, earning $12 a week as a runner. Then he worked as an assistant board boy, scurrying to and fro in a customer's room, changing stock prices on a chalkboard. Graham parlayed these jobs into a career through a classic Wall Street maneuver. He did research on the side until one day a floor broker gave a report he had written, negatively appraising the bonds of the Missouri Pacific Railroad, to a partner at Bation Company, which hired him as a statistician. Later, he returned to Neuberger, Henderson, and Loeb as a partner, where he remained until 1923. Then, a group of financial backers, including members of the Rosenwald family, early partners in Sears, lured him away by providing him with starting capital of $250,000, which enabled him to go out on his own. Graham closed this business in 1925 when he and his backers disagreed over his compensation and established the Benjamin Graham Joint Account on January 1, 1926, with $450,000 from clients and his own money. Shortly afterward, Jerome Newman, the brother of one of his clients, offered to make an investment in the firm and joined Graham as a partner at no salary until he learned the business and added value. Graham, however, insisted on paying him, modestly at first, and Newman brought to the partnership a broad general knowledge of business as well as management skills. In 1932, Graham wrote a series of articles in Forbes, "Is American Business Worth More Dead Than Alive?" in which he chastised company managements for sitting on troves of cash and investments, and investors for overlooking this value, which was not reflected in the prices of stocks. Graham knew how to dislodge the value, but his problem was capital. Through its stock market losses, the firm's account was down from $2.5 million to $375,000, including distributions, withdrawals, and losses. Graham felt responsible for recouping his partner's losses, but that meant he would have to more than triple their money. It would take some doing even to keep the joint account alive. Jerry Newman's father-in-law saved it by putting in $50,000, and by December 1935, Graham did triple the money and earned the losses back. For tax reasons, in 1936, Graham and Newman reorganized the joint account into two businesses, Graham Newman Corporation and Newman and Graham. Graham Newman charged a fixed fee and had issued shares to the public, which now traded on an exchange. Newman and Graham was a hedge fund, or private partnership with a limited number of sophisticated partners, that paid Graham and Newman based on their performance as managers. The two men remained partners for 30 years, although in his memoir, Graham cited Jerry Newman's lack of amiability, his demanding, impatient, and fault-finding personality, and his inclination to be too tough in negotiation. Newman, said Graham, was far from popular, even among his friends, of whom he had many, and had numerous quarrels with close associates, which he always made up in the end. He and Graham got along because of Graham's protective coating. Other people's behavior never seemed to disturb Graham's equanimity. The one exception to this was Graham's penchant for taking on established business figures in a fight. Through diligent research, digging through a report published by the Interstate Commerce Commission, he had discovered that Northern Pipeline, an oil transmission company whose stock sold for $65, owned railroad bonds worth $95 per share in addition to its pipeline assets. However, the Rockefeller Foundation, which controlled the stock, was doing nothing to release the value of the railroad bonds to shareholders. The stock traded at a depressed price that did not reflect the value of the bonds, so Graham began quietly accumulating shares until his firm became the largest owner after the Rockefeller Foundation. Then he pushed for the bonds to be distributed to the shareholders. Northern Pipelines Management, who had come from Standard Oil when it was broken up in 1911, gave him a runaround. It said the company needed to keep the bonds in order to be able to pay for replacing the aging pipeline someday. But Graham knew better. Finally, the managers simply said, "Running a pipeline is a very complex and specialized business, about which you know very little, but which we have done for a lifetime. If you don't agree with our policies, why don't you just sell your shares?" But Graham viewed his role as serving all the company's investors, not just himself, and instead of selling, he went down to the shareholders' meeting in remote Oil City, Pennsylvania, where he was the only person who attended other than company employees. He made a motion about the railroad bonds, but the management refused to recognize him because he had brought no one along to second the motion. In its dealings with him, the management also made what he felt were some anti-Semitic innuendos, which hardly inclined him to give up the fight. Over the next year, he bought additional shares, teamed up with other investors, and prepared to mount a legal battle with management, a proxy fight. By the time of the next shareholders' meeting, he had assembled enough votes to get two additional directors elected to the board, which tilted the balance in favor of distributing the bonds. The company submitted and ended up handing out the equivalent of $110 per share in cash and stock to its shareholders. The battle became a famous incident on Wall Street, and Graham went on to build the Graham Newman Corporation into one of the best known, although far from the largest, investment firms in the business. He did it even while inflicting a handicap on his own performance. His teaching style used examples taken directly from Graham Newman's office. Every time he mentioned a stock in the classroom, the students ran out and bought it, pushing up the price and making it more expensive for Graham Newman to buy. This drove Jerry Newman crazy. Why make the firm's job harder by letting other people in on what they were doing? To make money on Wall Street meant keeping your ideas to yourself. But, as Buffett said, Ben didn't really care how much money he had. He wanted to have enough, and he went through that period in 29 to 33 that was very rough. But if he had as much money as he felt he needed, anything else was totally immaterial to him. Over the 20-year life of Graham Newman Corporation, its performance had beaten the stock market's performance by an average of 2.5% a year, a record exceeded by only a handful of people in the history of Wall Street. That percent might sound trifling, but compounded for two decades, it meant that an investor in Graham Newman wound up with almost 65% more in his pocket than someone who earned the market's average result. Much more important, Graham had achieved this superior performance while taking considerably less risk than someone who simply invested in the stock market as a whole. And Graham did it mainly through his skill at analyzing numbers. Before him, assessments of a security's value were largely guesswork. Graham developed the first thorough, systematic way of analyzing the value of a stock. He preferred to work by studying only publicly available information, usually a company's financial statements, and rarely attended even public meetings with a company's management. Although his associate Walter Schloss had been at the Marshall Wells meeting, it was his own idea to go, not Graham's. Ben's third wife, Esty, drove her husband up to Columbia from the Graham Newman Corporation's office at 55 Wall Street every Thursday afternoon after the market closed to teach his Seminar on Common Stock Valuation. This course was the culmination of the Columbia Finance curriculum, so highly regarded that men who were already working in money management signed up for it, sometimes more than once. Warren, of course, looked up to Graham with worshipful awe. He had read the Northern Pipeline story over and over when he was 10 years old, well before he understood who Benjamin Graham was in the investing world. Now he hoped to bond with his teacher. But outside the classroom, he and Ben had few hobbies in common. Graham dabbled in the arts and sciences in a quest for knowledge, writing poetry, failing spectacularly as a Broadway playwright, and puttering around filling notebooks with ideas for clumsy inventions. He also devoted himself to ballroom dancing, clumping around for years at the Arthur Murray Studio, where he danced like a wooden soldier and counted the steps out loud. During dinner parties, Graham often disappeared in the middle of a course to work on mathematical formulas, read Proust in French, or listen to the opera in solitude, rather than suffer the dull company of his fellow man. "I remember the things I learn," he wrote in his memoir, "rather than the things I live." The one exception where living took precedence over learning was his assignations. About the only way a human being competed with the classic authors for Graham's attention was to be female and beddable. He was short and physically unimposing, but people had told him that his sensual full lips and penetrating blue eyes reminded them of the actor Edward G. Robinson. There was something elfish-looking about him, and he was not a handsome man. Nonetheless, Graham seemed to be a Mount Everest for women who liked a challenge. They met him and wanted to climb on top. In his three wives, Graham's taste had ranged wide. From the passionate, strong-willed teacher Hazel Mazur to Broadway showgirl Carol Wade, 18 years his junior, to his third wife and former secretary, the intelligent, light-hearted Estelle Esty Messing. Complicating all these marriages was his complete indifference to monogamy. Graham later wrote a memoir in which he begins, "Let me describe my first extramarital affair in the soberest fashion," a sobriety he giddily abandons 6 sentences later as he explains the recipe for his liaison with the sharp-tongued, by no means beautiful, Jenny. One part attraction and 4 parts opportunity. If more attraction was present, he needed less opportunity, making him shameless, even annoying, in his sexual advances toward women he found attractive. Combining 2 of his hobbies, Graham might dash off a seductive little poem to a woman he fancied on the subway, yet he was so cerebral that, even for his lovers, it must have been a challenge to hold his attention. The darting from amour to business in the following passage of the memoir is pure Graham. "I have a sentimental memory of the last hour we spent together in the cabin of her Ward Line steamer. Little did I think then that my firm was later to control that old established steamship company." He drove his wives to distraction with his philandering. But Warren, at the time, knew nothing about Graham's personal life and was focused only on what he could learn from the brilliant teacher. On the first day of Graham's seminar in January 1951, Warren walked into a smallish classroom containing a long rectangular table. In the middle sat Graham, surrounded by 18 or 20 men. Most of the other students were older, some of them war veterans. Half were not Columbia students, but businessmen who were auditing the course. Once again, Warren was the youngest, yet also the most knowledgeable. When Graham asked a question, inevitably he would be the first one to have his hand up and immediately start talking, recalls one of his classmates, Jack Alexander. The rest of the class became the audience to a duet. In 1951, many American businesses were still worth more dead than alive. Graham encouraged his students to use real-life examples from the stock market to illustrate this. Down-and-dirty companies such as Greif Brothers Cooperage, a barrel maker whose stock Warren owned. Its main business was slowly disappearing, but whose stock was trading at a substantial discount to the cash that could be netted if its properties and inventory were simply sold off and its debts repaid. Eventually, Graham reasoned, that intrinsic value would surface the way a river-tossed barrel, trapped under winter ice, pops to the surface in a spring thaw. You had only to interpret the balance sheet, decoding the numbers that proved there was a barrel of money trapped under the ice. Graham said that a company is no different than a person who might think that her net worth was $7,000, comprising her house, worth $50,000, less her mortgage of $45,000, plus her other savings of $2,000. Just like people, companies have assets that they own, such as the products they make and sell, and debts or liabilities that they owe. If you sold all the assets to pay off the debts, what would be left was the company's equity, or net worth. If someone could buy the stock at a price that valued the company cheaper than its net worth, Graham said, eventually, a tricky word, eventually, the stock's price would rise to reflect this intrinsic value. It sounded simple, but the art of security analysis lay in the details, playing detective, probing for what assets were really worth, excavating hidden assets and liabilities, considering what the company could earn or not earn, and stripping apart the fine print to lay bare the rights of shareholders. Graham students learned that stocks were not abstract pieces of paper, and their value could be analyzed by figuring out what the whole pie of a business was worth, then dividing it into slices. Complicating matters, however, was that issue of eventually. Stocks often traded at odds with their intrinsic value for long periods of time. An analyst could figure everything right and still appear wrong in the eyes of the market for the investing equivalent of a lifetime. That was why, as well as being a detective, you had to build in what Graham and Dodd called a margin of safety, that is, plenty of room for error. Graham's method struck people who studied it in one of two ways. Some grasped it immediately as a fascinating, all-consuming treasure hunt, and others recoiled from it as a dreary homework assignment. Warren's reaction was that of a man emerging from the cave in which he had been living all his life, blinking in the sunlight as he perceived reality for the first time. His former concept of a stock was derived from the patterns formed by the prices at which pieces of paper traded. Now he saw that those pieces of paper were simply symbols of an underlying truth. He instantly grasped that the patterns formed by trading these pieces of paper did not signify a stock any more than those childhood piles of bottle caps had signified the effervescent, sweet, sour, spicy taste of soda pop that made people crave it. His old notions dissolved in an instant, conquered by Graham's ideas and illuminated by the way he taught. Graham used all kinds of nifty, effective tricks in his class. He would ask paired questions, one at a time. His students thought they knew the answer to the first, but when the second came along, it made them realize that maybe they didn't. He would put up descriptions of two companies, one in terrible shape, practically bankrupt, another in fine form. After asking the class to analyze them, he would reveal that they were the same company at different times. Everyone was surprised. These were memorable lessons on thinking independently, typical of how his mind worked. Along with his Company A and Company B teaching method, Graham used to talk about Class 1 and Class 2 truths. Class 1 truths were absolutes. Class 2 truths became truths by conviction. If enough people thought a company's stock was worth X, it became worth X until enough people thought otherwise. Yet that did not affect the stock's intrinsic value, which was a Class 1 truth. Thus, Graham's investing method was not simply about buying stocks cheap. As much as anything, it was rooted in an understanding of psychology, enabling its followers to keep their emotions from influencing their decision-making. From Graham's class, Warren took away three main principles that required nothing more than the stern discipline of mental independence. A stock is the right to own a little piece of a business. A stock is worth a certain fraction of what you would be willing to pay for the whole business. Use a margin of safety. Investing is built on estimates and uncertainty. A wide margin of safety ensures that the effects of good decisions are not wiped out by errors. The way to advance, above all, is by not retreating. Mr. Market is your servant, not your master. Graham postulated a moody character called Mr. Market, who offers to buy and sell stocks every day, often at prices that don't make sense. Mr. Market's moods should not influence your view of price. However, from time to time, he does offer the chance to buy low and sell high. Of these points, the margin of safety was most important. A stock might be the right to own a piece of a business, and the intrinsic value of the stock was something you could estimate, but with a margin of safety, you could sleep at night. Graham built in his margin of safety in various ways. As well as buying things for considerably less than he thought they were worth, he never forgot the danger of using debt. And although the 1950s had become one of the most prosperous eras in American history, his early experiences had scarred him and given him the habit of assuming the worst. He looked at business through the lens of his 1932 Forbes articles, as worth more dead than alive, thinking of a stock's value mostly in terms of what the company would be worth if dead, That is, shut down and liquidated. Implicitly, Graham was always looking over his shoulder at the 1930s, when so many businesses went into bankruptcy. He kept his firm small in part because he was so risk-averse, and he rarely bought more than a tiny position in any company's stock, no matter how sound the business. This meant the firm owned a large array of stocks that required much tending. While plenty of stocks did sell at prices below the business's liquidation value, which made Warren an enthusiastic follower of Graham, he disagreed with his teacher about the need to buy so many stocks. He had cast his lot with one stock. Ben would always tell me Geico was too high. By his standards, it wasn't the right kind of stock to buy. Still, by the end of 1951, I had 3/4 of my net worth, or close to it, invested in Geico. And yet Warren worshipped his teacher, even though he had strayed so far from one of Graham's ideas. As the spring semester wore on, Warren's classmates gradually accepted the routine of the classroom duet. Warren was a very focused person. He could focus like a spotlight, 24 hours a day almost, 7 days a week almost. "I don't know when he slept," says Jack Alexander. He could quote Graham's examples and come up with examples of his own. He haunted the Columbia Library, reading old newspapers for hours on end. "I would get these papers from 1929. I couldn't get enough of it. I read everything, not just the business and stock market stories. History is interesting, and there is something about history in a newspaper, just seeing a place, the stories, even the ads, everything. It takes you into a different world, told by somebody who was an eyewitness, and you are really living in that time." Warren collected information, weeding out biases imposed by other people's way of thinking. He spent hours reading the Moody's and Standard & Poor's manuals, looking for stocks. But it was the weekly Graham seminar that he looked forward to more than anything else he did. He even convinced his disciple Fred Standback to come in and audit a class or two.